Good afternoon, I'm Loreto Rojas.
And I'm Cal Winslow.
We are back with Talking About California, this time with a series observing Hispanic Heritage Month.
And beginning today, we will focus on the implications of the movement for Black Lives Matter on the Latino community.
Altogether, we will have four interviews from the middle of September to the middle of October, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. here in KCYX.
Our first guest is UCLA professor Zepeda Milan. He's an associate professor of public policy, Chicano studies, and political science at UCLA.
Zepeda Milan is the author of Latino Mass Mobilization, Immigration, Radicalization, and Activism. It received multiple national honors, including the prestigious Ralph G. Bunche Best Book on Ethnic and Cultural Pluralism Award from the American Political Science Association.
And he's currently working on a book tentatively titled Walls, Cages, and Family Separation, Immigration Policy in the Time of Trump. Welcome, Professor. Is that book finished?
It is. It should be out this month or next month, actually.
And can we call you Chris?
Yes, please do.
So thank you so much for coming, Chris, today. We wanted to begin asking you a little bit about yourself. Can you tell us how and why you decided on Chicano Latino studies and public policy?
Sure. Well, I'm a third generation Mexican-American. I'd identify as Chicano. My father and grandparents from that side of the family were migrant farm workers. My grandparents on my mother's side were garment workers or sweatshop workers in downtown Los Angeles. I was born and raised in probably the largest and amongst one of the oldest Mexican-American or Mexican immigrant barrios in the country in East Los Angeles, and it's called Boyle Heights. And I was born and raised there, and I was a Chicano studies major as an undergraduate, and now I'm a professor of Chicano and Central American studies, and it's really been central, I think, to my academic success and career. Like I said, I grew up in East LA, which was arguably the heart of the Chicano movement in the 1960s and 70s, and yet I knew nothing about the Chicano movement. I knew nothing about Mexican-American history, right? There are literally murals painted all over my entire neighborhood about this history, yet I never thought twice about them. I never looked at them twice. I had to actually leave my neighborhood and go to college in order to learn about my own history because I wasn't taught it in school in Los Angeles, right? We were taught British literature, but not Latino-American literature. But when I took my first Chicano studies class in college, it really changed my life. You know, for the first time, I was reading stories that I could personally identify with. They were actually describing the streets I grew up in.
Wow.
You know, they were talking about, in a literature class I was taking, they were talking about similar family dynamics, about, you know, hearing these family stories of migrant farm work, which I remember growing up and hearing from my father and grandparents. I always hated reading, you know, but that one literature class, I think, really kind of changed my life. It really got me hooked. After that, I wanted to read anything and everything related to Latinos and Mexican-American history and politics. I think to me it was life-changing. I learned things like not only that you could be a Latino and a creative writer, but also, you know, the fact that we have a stake in this country. We helped build this country, and that my family and my community, you know, that there were reasons. Despite being extremely hardworking, there were reasons why we were poor. There were reasons why we lived all in the same neighborhood, right? And you know, these were very systemic and historical reasons. It wasn't because we fell into these stereotypes of being lazy Mexicans and things like that, right? When my reality was the opposite. My whole family was super hardworking. They didn't take a day off. you know, so I think for me, ethnic studies, Chicano Latino studies was really transformative and life-changing.
Yes. So one of the things that I was reflecting and we were discussing with Carl when we were talking about interviewing you today, Chris, were these terms. And we are not sure if our audience understands the difference between Chicano, Latino, and now this term Latinx. So yeah. Could you please give us a little bit of a history lesson And let's talk about the issue with Latino and Latinx.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has always been an issue with people from Latin American descent in the United States, right? Even if you just look at the census, for example, the census has hardly ever known, like, it's always changed, actually, of how it refers to quote, on what we consider today Latinos, right? At one point, it called us Spanish, and other times it called us, the census label was actually just Mexican, you know, Latin American, and it, you know, Mexican was actually a racial label at one point, right? So now it's kind of like you choose your quote unquote race, but then there's an ethnicity group, right? So labeling, and actually recently, a few years ago, they were actually going to add a new racial label where Latino was going to be its own specific, unique racial group. So historically, in terms of government, the way government has had a problem and issues identifying us, but so have we, right? We've changed. The community has changed. The communities has diversified. You know, before people of Mexican descent, you know, for a lot of times they wanted to just identify as American, right? Yet it was a broader white Anglo population that would continue to refer to them as Mexican despite their immigration status, right? So you kind of, we had this like early 1900s up until the 50s, I would say, maybe early 60s, of Mexican Americans wanting to identify as American, wanting to assimilate, believing into the melting pot. And yet the realities were the exact opposite, right? They were segregated. There was high levels of lynching against Mexican Americans and against people of Mexican descent all throughout the Southwest, especially Texas. There were signs that said, you know, no dogs, Negroes or Mexicans allowed, right? So segregation was a very real thing. Violence against Mexicans was a very real thing. So as much as people of Mexican descent wanted to identify as American, America didn't want them, right? Or the United States, I should say, didn't want them, right? And then, you know, you have the rise in response to that, a failure to want to integrate despite being, you know, going to World War I, going to World War II in defense of this country and coming back to that segregation. In the 1960s, you had a whole new generation of mostly second and third generation Mexican Americans saying, you know what, you continuously try to make us feel ashamed of our Mexican heritage, specifically our indigenous roots, you know, and instead of being ashamed of being Mexican, instead of begging you to be accepted as a U.S. American, we're going to actually embrace our Mexican heritage. We're going to actually embrace the part of our Mexican heritage that you want us to be most ashamed of, which is our indigeneity, right? So they chose a term that historically was a negative term, that's Chicano, right? And the histories of the history of that term itself has been contested. But for the most part, people think that the word Chicano comes from the broader term, which was from Mexicano, Mexica. Mexica was the actual term that the Aztecs, you know, identified as, right? So for short, they call them, they're the Mexicanos. And for short, they call them Chicanos. That term Chicano ended up having a negative connotation in the U.S. It was meant to be, to call a Mexican or a Mexican immigrant even, someone that was like the poorest of the poor, someone that was kind of low class, right? Well, in the 1960s, these third, second and third generation Mexican Americans, they said, we're going to take that term and we're going to transform it. And we're going to actually, everything you say that is negative, it's negative about our culture, about us, we're going to turn that into a positive. And we're going to actually embrace that term and radically change its definition of it, right? So now, post 1960s, the term Chicano came to identify a politicized Mexican American who did not identify, you know, as white, did not want to completely assimilate, right? But that was proud of their Mexican heritage and proud of their indigenous roots as well, right? Things that they were always told to be ashamed of, right? So the term Chicano became embraced amongst political activists throughout the Southwest. As we know, there was a lot of sexism within the civil rights movements, all of the civil rights movements, and the Chicano movement was no different, right? So at that point, during these movements, right, Chicanas, you know, Mexican-American women who were being politicized started questioning terms and terms like even like the language, right? And they decided like, hey, the Spanish language is a very gendered language and, you know, it's very kind of male-centric in a sense. And we want to highlight you know, that Chicanos are not all males, right? So they started identifying as Chicana, right? And you started seeing, and it kind of trickled into the universities when Chicano studies programs are starting to be established. You started seeing the way they would spell Chicano would be, you know, Chicano slash A, to highlight that they're both masculine and feminine. At the time, these were terms that were being used at the time. Or the opposite, Chicana slash O. You know, then in the 90s, there was an attempt to say, well, you know what, there's also queer Chicanas and Chicanos, right? So they did away with the A slash O, and they started using the at sign type of thing, because it kind of looked like a Q and a circle, but captured an A and an O at the same time. My undergraduate university, that's what it had. It kind of had the at sign, and that was supposed to include queer Chicanos and Chicanas as well, right?
Chris, that's very interesting, because that's the way I deal with this gender issue. Yeah, and I teach Spanish here at Mendocino College, and this is a discussion we always have, and I really like that symbol, you know, the art symbol, because in one image conveys all this discussion.
Mm-hmm. So I think the interesting part, and that was the kind of thing that I grew up with in the 90s and early 2000s, was that kind of at sign. But demographics change, politics change, right? From my understanding now, and this is kind of a younger generation than me, they've rightly pointed out that yes, people of Mexican descent are still the vast majorities of the Latino population, right? And Latino is a pan-ethnic label that is meant to encompass people from all of Latin American descent, right? But they point out rightly that it's not just Mexicans anymore, especially in the Southwest. There's a lot of Central Americans now, you know, and a lot of them identify more as Latin American, you know, so they started, a lot of people started saying, well, our struggles were being racialized the same. We're being treated the same. White America can't tell the difference between a Mexican and a Central American, right? Unfortunately, Central Americans have been historically lumped in and just been considered Mexicans and treated like Mexicans here, right? So I think in an attempt to kind of build more of this kind of pan-ethnic solidarity, people started using the term Latino, right? To say, look, I'm still Mexican. I could still be Chicano, all right? But then there's this broader term that then also identifies that. And I also still have similarities and a similar history and similar struggles as other people of Latin America descent, and arguably people in Latin America as well. So I think Latino was an attempt, just like the term Hispanic, you know, to kind of create this kind of pan-ethnic label. There's an amazing book by one of my former colleagues, Cristina Mora, a sociologist at UC Berkeley. And her book actually traces that history of how academics, activists, government bureaucrats, and ethnic media work together to help kind of form and create this Hispanic label and to really get Latinos across the country to buy into it, right? Because if you're able to claim to be a national majority, that opens yourself up to a lot of more political influence, right? Amongst political parties and government services as well, right? You could say, hey, we're a Latino group just like African Americans. We're a national minority group, right? And we also wanna take part in the national politics. I think, you know, they're not mutually exclusive terms. You could still be Chicano and Latino, right? But I think Latino tries to identify with other groups as well, besides your specific national origin group. Recently, I think the X has come in, because I think it's a overt, from my understanding, and I may be wrong here, but it's an overt gesture to include the trans community as well, which historically has also been marginalized even within the gay and lesbian community, right? And, you know, and I think the X, I'm thinking of, like, you know, same similar to African Americans, Malcolm X, right, during that whole movement where people use the X as being, like, excluded, unknown, and wanting to know that, right? I think the X kind of says, look, whatever you identify now, and it's a questioning of this binary, right, of gay, straight, male, female, Chicano, Latino, right? I think the X is meant to kind of say, like, let's break from these binaries. We're going to have an X, and however you identify, right, the term seems to be all-encompassing, right? So I think for older people like me, we still haven't gotten used to using it. You know, I always slip up with it, and some people just don't like it. They're like, you know, other people are like, great. You know, this generation wants to do it. My generation had the at sign. You know, we'll wait and see in 10 years, I'm sure it'll change again, right? I saw an article today questioning even using the term Latino or Latina, saying, hey, you know, if our critique of the term Hispanic is that it's very Eurocentric and it highlights our Spanish roots at the expense of our indigenous and Black roots in Latin America, right? That was a critique of the term Hispanic that a lot of activists had. What's the difference between Hispanic and Latino, right? Latin, you know, is also European, right? And arguably also a neglected, right? So I think these terms get super complicated, right? I think people, you know, there's good arguments on each side, but, you know, for whatever reason right now, this generation of millennials and younger feel that they really want to push the Latinx label, you know? My personal opinion is that whether I use them or not, I think that, you know, the more inclusive we could be, if it's politically strategic, then I don't have a problem with it.
Oh, that's really great. Thank you very much. And I think listeners will be informed by that. But let's get to the heart of the series that we're beginning, and that's the Black Lives Matter, which has exploded again across the country with huge demonstrations, as you know, all over the place. And even as the movement seems to have been moving people, the police killings continue. So I don't know if you what the situation is down in Los Angeles, but I recently read that even in this summer, there have been more than a dozen police killings of unarmed civilians in Los Angeles. So maybe you could tell us how you look at the Black Lives Matter movement from your vantage as a Latino.
Sure. So thinking about the Black Lives Matter from, I guess, a Latino perspective, well, I think it's important to recognize that Latinos are a very diverse population, right? So I think probably the vast majority of Latinos in the U.S. are of mestizo or indigenous backgrounds, but many also are or I think would be racialized as what we consider Black, right? Especially Latinos on the East Coast where there's more Caribbean, but also amongst a lot of Central American and even some Mexican Latinos as well, right? That would get racialized as Black in the United States. So I think if you're a Latino that's racialized as Black, your approach to the movement, you approach the movement from a very unique perspective because you've likely been marginalized from within the broader non-Black Latinx community, from within the larger white society, and maybe even from an African-American community that doesn't really understand the Latin American or the immigrant experience. I think if you're a non-Black Latino, a lot of us are having some important conversations with our families about our conscious and unconscious anti-Blackness within our own communities, within our own families, right? Which again, I think it could get pretty tricky at times because a lot of times Black and Brown communities are pitted against each other, right? Especially in inner cities where sometimes Latino immigrants have had bad experiences with Black neighbors being anti-immigrant, right? Or with Black managers at work. Right. So a lot of this tension, I think, sometimes will come out when you try to have conversations about anti-Blackness within the Latino community. Right. Rather than saying, OK, yeah, those things happened and they weren't good. Right. That doesn't take us away from talking about anti-Blackness, our own anti-Black feelings and sentiments within the Latino community. Right. But I think the key is trying to figure out what the root causes of those tensions sometimes that exist within these communities are, where do they come from, right? And they're usually historical and systemic, which again, I think is why ethnic and Latinx studies is really important for not only students, but for the broader society to learn about, right? Because Latino immigrants come to the United States, you know, mostly not knowing anything about the U.S. experience, mostly not knowing about the African-American experience, the African-American civil rights movement, right? Not knowing that there's reasons why African-Americans have been historically marginalized and are still economically and socially marginalized today, right? They don't even know about their own U.S.-born Latino immigrant social justice and civil rights experiences, right? They're coming from a completely different historical and political context, right? So I think in this sense, knowing these shared histories of oppression, knowing these, you know, where our our struggles intersect is super important. When it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement, and going back to your initial questions in terms of from a Latinx perspective, I think if you're a Black or non-Black Latino, you're going to come at the movement from a different perspective. But we're seeing here, though, that one thing is for sure, that the Latino community and especially Latino youth are really showing up for a lot of these actions and demonstrations, especially on the West Coast.
Right. It seems that there is a lack of education that you were pointing out at the beginning of the interview by telling us how you never learned of any of these issues in school. But now these big demonstrations and, of course, the use of technology that allows us to see these horrible abuses against Black and people of color, as they have been called now, to include a larger group of people that have been marginalized. So that really has allowed for a wider group of people, for the public, you know, the general public, to understand more about what's happening with these groups. So we wanted to ask you also, how's it going about the things with the police and the Latino communities specifically? What are the issues that stand out and how those are different or not from what the marginalized neighborhoods of where the Black people lives are experiencing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so I think just before the BLM protests erupted here in Los Angeles, there was a big case that got a lot of local media attention of a LAPD officer that was beating a Mexican-American here in Boyle Heights in East Los Angeles. Literally for no apparent reason. The guy was up against the wall, and the LA police officers just kept punching him and punching him, and the guy was not resisting, right? And that was caught on tape, right? Somebody recorded it on their phones, and it went viral. So I think instances like this do happen to Latinos, right? Especially inner city Latinos, right? There is tension, and there historically has been. You know, the LAPD has historically been one of the most corrupt major city police departments in the country. Yes, it's been improved to some degree, but we still have issues with law enforcement. Recently, there's been a story how the Los Angeles sheriffs, which have also a really dark history, has admitted to having multiple gangs within their department amongst sheriff deputies, right? And there's been a whistleblower recently where a sheriff deputy has said that he was bullied and beat up by these sheriff gangs, you know, who go out onto the streets and do really messed up things, not only to the communities, you know, but to other sheriff deputies, right? So recently we had this horrible shooting of these two sheriffs in Compton, right, here in Los Angeles, which is a horrible and horrific act, you know, but I think to understand why somebody in the community would do such a horrific act, right, we also have to be like, okay, what is the relationship between the sheriffs, the Compton sheriffs and the Compton community, right? And ironically or tellingly, one of these sheriff gangs, the most notorious ones, are called the Executioners, and they're in the Compton Sheriff Department, right? And they have this history of beating people, right? So I think, you know, including Latinos, right? So I think Los Angeles in particular does have a long history. I think in general with the LAPD, it's improved to some degree, right? But yes, there is these instances of police beatings of Latinos in Los Angeles, but not to the same degree that it happens to African Americans. You know, I think when it comes to African Americans' relationship with the police, at least with local police agencies, it's a very unique, and they're more disproportionately impacted by police departments. For Latinos, the type of policing I think that impacts us disproportionately is border policing that has pushed thousands of migrants into the most deadliest parts of the southwestern desert, that has led to the deaths of at least definitely over 10,000 dead Latino bodies found along the border, right? So the Border Patrol actually has a policing strategy that they call prevention through deterrence, where they say, we're going to deter Latino immigrants from coming by pushing them into the deadliest part of the day. And in fact, their actual document says we're going to put their lives in mortal danger, and that's going to deter them from wanting to come. Well, we know when people are starving, when people need to feed their families, they're willing to take risk their lives to come work here in the United States. So it definitely hasn't stopped Latino immigration, but what it does have is increase the number of deaths through that crossing, right? So border policing disproportionately impacts the Latino community on the border that has led to thousands of deaths. But now immigration policing has moved into the interior of the United States as well. And we see it most recently with these local police and immigration policing joint policing agreements and programs like Secure Communities or 287G, where a simple traffic stop or driving while brown, driving while immigrant could lead to family separation, detention, and ultimately deportation, right? Which is all over the Spanish language media every day, but virtually ignored by the mainstream English language media. So I think most other Americans, including white and black Americans, are really unaware of this unique form of policing that has a disproportionately negative effect on Latino communities. So the issue of policing isn't new to us, right? Latino activists have been calling, you know, for the abolishment of ICE, for example, for a long time. That is an anti-policing movement, right? It wasn't framed as policing. It was saying abolish ICE, but it's a form of immigration policing. So I think Latinos are uniquely impacted by police and disproportionately negative impacted, but in different ways than the African-American community.
Let's pause for a second here. This is Loretta Rojas and Kel Winslow. We're your hosts today. And this is KZYX, Mendocino Community Listener-Supported Radio. And our guest this afternoon is UCLA Professor Chris Cepeda Milan. And he's the Professor of Public Policy and Chicano Studies and Political Science at UCLA. We're just talking a bit about ICE. How does that show itself in a huge city like Los Angeles, where there are so many Latino people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all around us, right? There's detention centers. We don't even know where all the detention centers are, and sometimes they're spread across the city, right? They're not meant to really stand out. You know, sometimes they could be hotels, right, that are rented right there. But here in Los Angeles, we know in downtown Los Angeles and in the federal building there, it's held as a detention center, right? So there's constantly protests there, people trying to highlight the fact that we have a detention center here. And then, you know, I think local activists have done a good job of slowly but surely pushing their city and county officials to now refuse to work with ICE. And you've seen that go up to the state level, right? Where we're a sanctuary state now, right? Where obviously we can't control and we can't stop the federal government. And that's what ICE agents are, the federal police, from coming in. But we could prevent or at least significantly limit the degree to which our local law enforcement work with ICE. And I think that's kind of what we've been pushing here in California and in Los Angeles. So I think major cities like New York, they also have detention centers within them. Yeah, it's definitely impacts us here too. And this is the most pro, or I would say the largest undocumented city in the country, right? With the largest Mexican American population in the country, right? Where you think we would have the most political power in the country. You know, and yet it's still a reality here in LA as well.
Right, because also here is the issue of representation. I mean, there are so many issues, but representation in the government, and then the presence of all these issues also in the mass media that is being ignored, right? So people are demonstrating, not only in this country, but in many other countries. And it seems that there is an agreement between the governments and the media of not making visible, what's really the issue here. So, you know, we are a rural county here in Northern California. Can you say something about what do you understand what's happening really in this rural California? And is Trump supporting the sheriffs? Because there is also a highly militarization of sheriff's departments in rural California.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and to some degrees, it's worse in rural areas, even if we don't hear about it. Because, well, one, a lot of these rural areas, right, they're still very, like, completely white-dominated local governments. Right, where the Latino community there is disproportionately immigrant and oftentimes disproportionately non-citizen, which means they don't really have an electoral and political voice. These rural smaller communities also don't have the same resources that urban cities, so they don't have a lot of NGOs. In LA, I can't even count how many immigrant rights organizations we have here. And then the power of the local labor movement, which is also super pro-immigrant, specifically pro-undocumented immigrant. Well, in a lot of rural communities, Latino immigrants don't have those kind of political brokers. They don't have a second and third generation Latino electorate that could vote on their behalf. They don't have immigrant rights organizations. They don't have, you know, civil rights lawyer groups, immigrant rights legal organizations. They don't have labor unions organizing them, right? So in many respects, they're politically more vulnerable in these rural communities than they would be, right? Which is why I think we don't see a lot. So I think that also impacts the power dynamics, right? Just because we might not see mass protests going on in rural areas, and not just rural California, but throughout the rural South, where the Latino immigrant population has also moved to as well, does not mean that there's no political issues, there's no forms of economic, social, and political oppression going on. Usually it just means that they're so suppressed that they can't even say anything about it, right? Because they don't have any political allies there, you know? So I don't know much about Mendocino County, but if it is these kind of rural areas, my guess is that the Latino immigrant population, the Latino population there is probably immigrant to a large degree, probably agricultural to a large degree, right? Which to me, I think, does not mean that there's no quote unquote problems there. To me, if anything, it highlights the power dynamics there, where because they lack citizenship, because they lack a large voting population on their behalf, their willingness to be able to publicly protest or even publicly complain, right, even about stolen wages and things like that, are severely limited and restricted, right? So I'm thinking here, for example, the last case of modern day slavery in the United States, the last cases were of rural Latino immigrants in Florida, right? These were rural migrant farm workers, yeah, communities in places like Immokalee, where there was no Mexican American vote. There was no major immigrant rights organizations, right? These are rural farm communities where they knew they were able to oppress these largely indigenous Mexican and Central American migrants there. So in many respects, I think even if we don't hear about immigration or immigrant rights issues in rural communities, I think the power dynamics there and the problems there you know, could often be a lot worse than in major cities.
You know, Chris, when I first started getting active, United Farm Workers movement was sort of central to all of us, really, whatever particular kind of work we did. It really was kind of the guiding light, you know, the sort of North Star of our movement. So we don't talk much about the labor movement in this county, but maybe you've mentioned it a couple of times. Maybe you could say a word about farm workers today and what the rest of the labor movement looks like, in especially, I suppose, in LA, what the rest of the labor movement looks like to you, again, from a Latino perspective.
That's a great question, and especially for California and Los Angeles in particular. I want to note the importance of the UFW, right? So they've been, the union is, it's still around. It's obviously has lost a lot of its power and influence. You know, so a lot of people talk about its decline, but its continuous impact and its importance, I think, is undeniable even for today, because one of the things that has transformed the labor movement in California and Los Angeles and then across the country was that a lot of the youth, white, black, and especially Latino youth and people who were involved in the UFW who gain experience organizing immigrants at a time that the country and the labor movement was very anti-immigrant, at a time when the labor movement was kind of what we call business unionism. They stopped organizing and they were just like, well, if we just donate money to Democratic politicians, that should be enough, right? At a time that was kind of the national understanding and dynamics of the labor movement, the UFW did was something that we call community unionism. They said, look, our workers aren't just workers. They're also mothers. their fathers, their parishioners, their students, right? And what the UFW did is it really kind of pioneered community unionism, where it went out there and they'd organize people in their homes and their neighborhoods and their churches. And a lot of the Chicano and other activists that took part in the UFW, after that movement kind of dwindled to a large degree, they went out and they became activists and took those lessons and those skills into other unions, specifically unions like SEIU, specifically unions like Unite Here, right? A lot of these former UFW activists went into the labor movement and repoliticized the labor movement. They said, look, the labor movement has been in decline in the numbers since the 1950s nationally, right? But one of the few places where it was actually increasing in membership was in California and in general, and in Los Angeles in particular. So in the late 90s, when the labor movement said, okay, we're dying, what's happening in California? Why are they growing there? They brought a lot of these activists, a lot of these union organizers, and they said, what are you all doing in California? And with these, including Chicano union organizers, said, well, we're actually not listening to you all as a national movement. We're not being anti-immigrant. We're not being anti-undocumented. We're actually organizing immigrants. That's how we're growing, right? And I think politically, Los Angeles is key because we had a great labor leader here named Miguel Contreras, who was an organizer with the UFW, I believe. And he ended up being the head of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor. And I wish we had this recorded. He spoke at my university when I was an undergrad, and it really had an impact on me. But he said, you know, we did an internal survey in Los Angeles and LA County, and trying to figure out, okay, the labor movement needs to get electoral political power if we want to, you know, if we want to make some important gains here. So who are the most pro-labor votes? And in their internal survey, they found that non-unionized Latinos were more pro-labor than union members. So Miguel Contreras had this brilliant idea and said, you know what, we're going to take labor resources and we're going to invest it in citizenship campaigns for immigrants, in naturalization, in voter registration campaigns for immigrants, and we're going to continue to organize immigrants, right? We're going to build this big merge immigrant rights and labor rights as one, right? And that was one of the ways that election after election, the labor movement was, you know, Los Angeles now, the city council is almost all, you can't win in LA without the labor movement support now, right? The Catholic Church could not have built the new cathedral in downtown Los Angeles without the permission of the local labor movement, which said, sure, you could build it, but it needs to be built by union workers. Right, same things with the Staples Center where the Los Angeles Lakers play. Labor had a big influence in even allowing it because of the political influence that it had. Right, so I think that was really a lesson for the national movement. And you saw eventually John Sweeney, the former head of the ASL-CIO, in 2000, they had their national conference, a big rally here in Los Angeles, where they announced that the AFL-CIO, the American Mainstream Labor Movement, was now pro-immigrant, pro-legalization, right? And they had local LA activists like the famous immigrant rights activist, Bert Corona, you know, come on stage and say, you know, labor now is one with immigrants. We believe in citizenship, we believe in legalization, and we believe in organizing again. Of course, nationally, not every union, you know, there's still some anti-immigrant unions, you know, still especially heavily white unions are still uncomfortable with demographic changes. But nonetheless, the significance of the AFL-CIO, at least publicly on paper, coming out as pro-immigrant now and using its national influence within the Democratic Party to be pro-legalization and pro-immigrant, I don't think you could really discount the significance of that, right? Because then you also see the Democratic Party then shift its position. And I went from being anti-undocumented immigrant, right, to now being pro-legalization, pro-citizenship. And more pro-Latino, right? So this fusion of labor and the immigrant and immigrant rights community, I think is was super fundamental for Latino politics in California in general, in Los Angeles in particular, and for Democratic politics nationally.
Thank you, Chris. If you are listening to our radio program this afternoon, this is talking about California celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. This is our first program of a new series of out of four airing on Tuesday at 3 p.m. And today we are conversing with Chris Cepeda. He's Cepeda Millan. He's the professor of public policy, Chicano studies, and political science at University of California in Los Angeles. Thank you, Chris, for joining us today. So going back to, so very interesting what you just have said about the labor movement and how it's been changing the way politics are being made in Los Angeles, and we hope in other places. But it seems that there are other many places where Anglos say, in effect, that white racism and police brutality is directed toward Blacks and not Latinos. Usually here in Mendocino County, we hear this, we have no problems with the Latinos, no? And that's not really the case, because in our little town here in Fort Bragg on the coast, they are discussing to change the name of the town because it's called Fort Bragg. And there is no fort, and we are all learning more than perhaps wanted about this person, this military brag. So, but and there are not many Black people, but many Latinos, and we have this issue with representation as well. So I wanted to ask you, how do you see or envision this change that you are describing in Los Angeles, how Latinos could actually empower their own communities and create the changes and make themselves visible? Because many times we discuss this with many whites that call themselves allies, and they don't even have an understanding or a grasp of what it means to be a Latino in many places.
Yeah, a great question. I think it's important to understand that just because a broader white society says that there, or a broader white community says, we have no problems with the Latinos, does not mean that Latinos don't have problems with that broader white society, right? Those are two very different things. And oftentimes our privileges blind us, right? You know, so I'm not here to demonize. I think that, you know, allies, their hearts could be in the right place, right? There's a lot of times that as a cis straight male that maybe I'm clueless about the trans and LGBT issues that are right in front of my face, but that I just don't see, right? Or the gender issues that I just don't see sometimes, right? You know, so I think.
And also, yes. Chris, and I'm not demonizing them neither, because they are my neighbors. We all live in this small rural area. But what has been interesting to me is that they are recognizing, many organizations are recognizing their own bias. And they are asking me, and we are trying to think collectively. So this is why I'm kind of inviting you to help me and help us as a community to figure it out, how we can really make this transition. Because we Latinos also sort of, I don't know how to say this, I'm going to say quote unquote, we know our place and we just stay there and we thrive and we live our lives very plentiful. Mm-hmm. It's not that we are completely oppressed or anything like that.
Yeah,
we don't have access to these other positions of where power can promote changes that will help next.
Sure. So. Yeah, I mean, and I think you don't have to, maybe there is an overt kind of oppression and things like that there, but that doesn't mean you should be excluded from the decision-making processes, right? So I think a good place to start is oftentimes, you know, with an encuentro within just the Latino community itself there and being just talking, having a safe space with just Latinos there to be able to voice their opinion, be like, okay, you know, what are the issues, if any, here? It might not even be with that small town. It might be with the broader county, but then that small town could help become allies to help them, you know, with some of these issues, right? Maybe like, for example, I don't know, your county might not have a 287G program with the local sheriffs, right? But the surrounding counties might have. If that would be the case, and it's really important for the broader white community to understand Latinos are basically trapped. It's an open air prison in that county because they can't actually drive outside of it. Because as soon as they cross that county line, right, they could easily be pulled over for driving while being immigrant, driving while being brown, and that could lead to a deportation. Right? Whatever the issues are, I think you start off with the community itself and be like, okay, what are some of the issues? It doesn't have to be police brutality. It could just be like, well, I wish our kids, you know, were able to, you know, have bilingual education. We think actually the white and the non-white kids would benefit from having some bilingual education here. Or it could be like, hey, we would love to, like, you know, the local schools to adopt, you know, an ethnic studies curriculum here where we learn about all different cultures, not just white contributions to the founding and the development of this country. You don't have to have Black people there to learn. In fact, you should learn about the contributions and the history of African Americans there, whether you're Black or not, right? So it might be some of these important issues that come up of different ways that could make them feel more welcoming. We've had non-citizen or immigrant voting in the United States longer than we have not had it, right? So local, it's completely possible for your local elections to actually allow non-citizens to vote, right? It's only in federal elections, again. Non-citizens are legally allowed to hold office and vote in small town elections and even citywide elections. New York, for example, right? There's a bunch of cities that actually had non-citizen immigrant voting, right? Something like that, maybe, you know, allowed to integrate them and be able to hold office, right? And be on a school board, to be on a, you know, even a city council, or whatever it is, right? In the end, it starts with the local community, figuring out what they feel, right? What they want, you know, and it doesn't have to be something major. And, you know, hopefully and thankfully, maybe it has nothing to do with police brutality, right? But it maybe just has to do with wanting to feel included in curriculums, wanting to feel, you know, included in other ways. But you're not going to know that until I think you talk to those communities themselves. And maybe you'll find nothing. You know, I just wouldn't take it just because the white community is saying we don't have issues or problems. I don't think, you know, that automatically means, okay, then there's no issue and problem. But it sounds like there's already allies there. And I think that's already a first great first step. People willing to listen and being open-minded about it. And I think you actually have more of a chance of creating important change in that local community than a lot of bigger cities.
Chris, we're going to continue in this series talking about, well, we thought of it originally as sort of a Brown Lives Matter series. I don't know if that expression is used at all. And so we used it a bit tentatively, but we're going to continue with that. And next time we're going to be talking about police in general. Has the discussion of police been raised in the labor movement and the political movement in Los Angeles, including things like defunding or redirecting funding? Has that come up?
Yeah, I think that's an uncomfortable conversation within the labor movement, because historically police unions and prison guard unions have been super powerful in Los Angeles and in California, right? And to some degree, the labor movement has benefited, right, from their union dues and things like that. But now I think for the first time, at least in my observation of Los Angeles politics, I think during the BLM protest, people started calling their other labor allies out and be like, hey, you should have a more quote unquote intersectional approach. And if the labor parts of the labor movement are having a disproportionately negative effect, like support for things like three strikes laws and, you know, more policing, then the labor movement needs to have that internal conversation. And I think for the first time, I had people questioning, like, why is it, you know, like, it's important to realize that police are workers and they have a very dangerous job, right? But that does not mean, you know, and I get the union's primary job is to protect their workers, but that doesn't mean that unions should protect their workers at the expense of other people's lives and at the expense of their own workers not being held accountable for bad things that they do. And unfortunately, as a union to their workers, they've been great. They've protected their police workers, you know, even when they shouldn't have, right? But I think now those actions are starting to be questioned, right? And pressure is being brought on the city council, I know for sure. And, you know, to be like, hey, police need to be held accountable. Whether they're workers or not, they could do bad things, right? So you're starting to have those conversations within the labor movement, right? We have these conversations when it comes to teachers all the time, right? You see the political right saying teachers need to be held accountable. Unions are protecting bad teachers. Right, that conversation disappears when it comes to police. All of a sudden, personal responsibility, all those right-wing talking points about unions holding their workers accountable for poor performance disappears when it comes to police, right? So I think we need to start having those conversations more. I've seen them happening a little by little here in Los Angeles for the first time, but this needs to be a broader national conversation. We should apply the same standards that we apply to teachers to police officers as well.
Excellent comparison, because this is what is being discussed a lot in the in the social media as well. You know, they say police cannot be defunded, and then they show teachers that need to buy all the supplies for the classes. So we have only a few more minutes, Chris, but we cannot let you go without asking you how teaching is going now that all the modality has changed, and what are the challenges now to keep on educating our young population to keep working and promoting this so important information, knowledge about our history and how that can change our communities. So tell us about what's happening for you in this department.
Yes, I think this should not be normal, and we should not accept it as normal. We should not call it the new normal. This isn't, you know, I think the teachers union here has a really good, like, we should not call this distant learning. This is crisis learning, right? And when you understand it as crisis learning, I think it allows us all to be a little bit more sympathetic with each other and to give each other a break, right? And I think elementary, middle school, and high school teachers have it the hardest. Right, because their kids don't have access oftentimes to strong Wi-Fi. Their kids are having to figure out ways to take care of their brothers and sisters and even their own family members, their parents and grandparents at the time. Right. So I think in that sense, we, you know, it's they're just getting by, and we have to accept that the quality of education is not going to be anywhere close to normal times. This is crisis attempted education. For me, last quarter and this quarter, I think it's been a little easier because I've taught two graduate level courses, you know, so they're smaller and we could have conversations. But next quarter, I'm supposed to teach an undergraduate course of 400 to 800 students. And I don't know how that's going to happen on Zoom. you know, so I think that's just from my understanding of people who continue to teach these classes. It's very difficult, and both students and faculty have to give each other a break and realize, like, this will be temporary. You know, and it's an attempt at crisis learning, right? And we should not get universities used to online stuff, because that's just another way to undermine labor and permanent teaching as well. So in some respects, it's important to understand this as crisis education so that it does not become normal and that universities don't try to do things more online, right? Because that just ends up being a labor issue as well.
How about, Chris, give us a plug for your new book. Tell us why we should run out and get a copy of it, and why our listeners. I'm already convinced, thanks to listening to you today, but what about our listeners? What's the book about?
Sure. So this is actually a different style. It's not a traditional book. Cambridge University Press is now producing these things called Elements. So it's different, you know, Cambridge is an academic press, and usually its audience is professors and students. The goal of these elements are to, these mini books, I like to call them, are to be shorter. So they're only about 30,000 words. They're supposed to be original research on a contemporary politically salient topic, right? So it's original research, it's academic based, but it's supposed to be short and, you know, for the public and for policymakers to understand and consume. So for us, when they approached me and my colleague to write something like this, we thought, okay, what are the most important issues facing the Latino community right now? And that was, at the time, Trump wanting to build the wall. It was children being, families being separated, and children's being put in cages to the largest degree that they've ever had, right? So we wanted to find out, why is the president doing this? Who supports this? And more importantly, why do the people that support it support it? So we did an original survey of white Americans to try to quantitatively or statistically figure out, do they support it, and who does, and to what degree? The good news is that the vast majority of white Americans do not support family separation, do not support putting children in cages. In fact, they actually support releasing children to family members and sponsors. There is more support for the wall amongst white communities, but what we're able to do statistically is figuring out why, like, who is supporting these things amongst the white community. And we found three general trends. It's white Americans who are not comfortable with the cultural impact of Latino immigration are the ones that support these horrific laws and policies more. White Americans who are not comfortable with the demographic changes and the idea that in a few decades, the United States is not going to be a majority white country anymore, right? So these kind of, and what we call racial resentment, right? White Americans who hold these kind of, what we would call racist beliefs about African Americans and other groups. So in other words, racial attitudes really help explain who among the white community supports walls, cages, and family separation.
Thank you so much, Chris. There's so many things to talk about, but our time is up, and we are very grateful that you came and talked to us, and I look forward to be informed and learn more about your work when you publish this book. And to our audience, this was Talking About California. I'm Loreto Rojas. I'm here today with Cal Winslow and Chris Cepeda. We will be back in a week, in September the 29th at 3 p.m. with another interesting interview. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.